And I have the distinct pleasure to have David Cole up here, and you were up here for a speaking engagement and to do some video work with us. Sadly, we are in Auschwitz together making films, right? Then we are in Munich together giving speeches. I appreciate your liberality. I'm not surprised now because I've gotten to know you a little better, and you are a liberal of the 19th century type, the way I feel I am, you know? Mm-hmm. We are far more tolerant actually than our enemies.
Yeah. Yeah, classical liberalism.
And,
yeah,
that each man and each woman have a right to say their piece and state their mind and all this kind of stuff. And our enemies who always call us bigots and closed minds and hate mongers and all this stuff, they could actually take a slice of us. You know?
Certainly. Even when I was not yet a revisionist, even when I still bought the entire Orthodox line, I was always infuriated by attempts to censor or to freeze somebody out of public discourse in some way or another. I felt everybody had a right to say what they wanted to say and to be respected for that.
In this time period, it was 92 to 93, David Cole was only 23 years old. He is of Jewish descent, as you'll hear. And this is his personal take on what he was able to gather as far as the facts on a particular situation.
Did your parents do that, teach you that?
My mother specifically. I was brought up much along the same lines of thought as I now speak to other people, of freedom being an end in and of itself, freedom being a benefit to society, and that people who try and obstruct someone else's freedom need to be fought, even if the person whose freedom is being obstructed is not connected with you in any way. Even if it's somebody else, you get just as much benefit out of fighting for someone else's freedom as for your own. So I try to live that in my daily life. Yeah. My biological father was a German Jew, and my father presently is an English Jew, although from Russia. They came to the United States before that wave of Russian Jewish immigrants. They were the financially better off German and other European Jews that came over before the wave of immigrants and established themselves in the South.
You mean like late last century? Or
yeah, right around the middle of last century.
Okay. People ask me, you know, what would motivate this young Jewish man to actually step so much out of line with Jewish political orthodoxy or social orthodoxy? Mm-hmm. You know, and so you then really go back to what you could call, but in political terms, old Republican money. You go back.
Yeah, he's saying that his family came over right around the mid-1800s.
To the older pre-communist revolutionary types who came out of Russia and so on.
I will say as well that there was always somewhat of an independent streak among certain Jews, but I would say that Zionism had a negative effect on that. If you studied Judaism before the dawn of the Age of Zionism in Israel, there was more dissent.
Sure.
Among Jews. And there was, and if you go back to before the 40s, there was a great debate among the Jewish community as pro and anti-Zionists really going at it. Many Jews who did not favor the taking of Palestine and the creation of Israel. And that debate was more or less stifled with the victory of the Zionists and somewhat of an all-encompassing takeover of all sides of Judaism by the Zionists.
Actually, I studied for my trial some of the microfilms for the New York Times, and I was amazed how Menachem Begin, the nasty press that he had up until the 50s in the United States. So that debate really raged well into the 50s.
And of course, this kind of brings the Holocaust into it, because a lot of Jews, much like my mother, more liberal Jews in America, who did not radically favor Israel, they didn't like the concept of taking the land from the Arabs, or of, in general, they didn't favor the concept of Jews being told to move to a desert where there was a war going on, as opposed to the relative comfort that they were in. But it was the Holocaust, and it was the bludgeoning with the Holocaust, and saying, we have to have this or else the Holocaust will happen again. We have to get out of Europe because Europe only wants to kill us. And it was the Holocaust that made most of the anti-Zionist Jews rethink their position and kind of give way towards the Zionists.
You know, this is one of the big things that you have taught me in those times that I've been together with you. The immense role that this Holocaust story plays for Jewish self-definition.
So they had to hype it up in order to get them to change their minds.
It wasn't clear to me before.
Yeah.
But you say it's even more important now than Torah or Talmud teaching. Yeah, really something.
Myself, I can take as a prime example. Because I was a secular Jew and therefore not religious, I was not bar mitzvahed. The only time I really went to temple was when my friends were bar mitzvahed. But because of the secularization and yet at the same time having the identity of being a Jew, something like the Holocaust became far more important because that was a defining factor of my Judaism, the history of persecution, hatred of Nazis, hatred of Germans, hatred of anti-Semites, whatever, whoever they are defined as then and now. That is what makes you a Jew. I've often said that because so many Jews nowadays are not physically that different from other white people, as opposed to, let's say, Asians or Blacks, right, who by their physical features are defined as separate, but many Jews, because of a lot of interbreeding in Europe with Europeans, are not that physically different. Jews need Jew haters to define them, so they create anti-Semites. They love having lists of anti-Semites because it is these anti-Semites that allow them to have the definition of being separate. And a Jew without a Jew hater is nothing. Jews need their anti-Semitism, which is why Jews invest so much in fighting anti-Semitism and calling attention to anti-Semitism and literally anything, any criticism of Israel or Israeli policies or criticism of what Jews might be doing will be labeled as anti-Semitism or Jew hatred, because Jews flourish from pointing to what they call Jew haters and anti-Semitism. It's more than just a fundraising tool for them. It's part of their identity to have enemies. Their enemies list defines them. What you see now coming out of the Zionist era, once Israel was established, you see somewhat of a special circumstance in the world for Jews, because now Jews can be a race, or they can be a religion, or they can be a nationality. If a Jew wants to, he can express his Judaism by a devotion to Israel, like secular nationalism, or he can show his Judaism by claiming to be racially a Jew. His parents were Jewish and he is. He can be an atheist but still be a Jew, or he can claim his Judaism by believing in the Old Testament or the Torah or studying the Talmud. So it's all at their disposal, these three things, and there are not too many other groups of people on earth that can claim those three things like that.
Now, can Jews easily move between those three, like select from it, like a menu?
Exactly.
One day this, the next day that, whenever it suits them? Or?
Exactly, and it enables the Jewish advocacy groups to select various pockets of Jews for support at any one time. When support is needed, they can target the nationalist, the Zionist community, or they can target the religious Jewish community, or they can simply target all Jews, saying, well, your parents were Jew, you're a Jew, you're the one that's going to be killed when the Nazis come back. It's by virtue of your race. And they can target any of those three groups or all three at the same time. It makes it very easy because the heart of political consulting, the heart of working in a political group is identifying a market of people and playing to that market. It's the exact same as advertising. When you go to these modern advertising facilities, they are doing demographic work, identifying markets. What are the 18 to 30 year olds buy? What are the 50 to 60 year old women buying?
Now, what you were saying then is that the difficulty that I faced of not being able to reach out, even though I've made for years these gestures of extending the hand of cooperation, if not friendship or whatever, at least a kind of a side-by-side, leaving both communities live side-by-side with our own concepts of history, I've gotten nowhere. And so is that possibly because they need me as a tool for self-definition? Mm-hmm. That would be a tragedy, you know?
That is a very good take on the situation. I think they need Ernst Sandel to kick around because putting your face like on the cover of the B'nai B'rith magazine, and you certainly get a lot of press, albeit negative press, but certainly press up here in Canada. And you are used as not only a fundraising tool, but also a tool in their identity. It is your presence and your the fact that they mold you as the great Satan, the Hitler, the person who will build the gas chambers again. They paint you that way because psychologically as well as financially, they are getting a boost from that.
So in a way, if I were to remove myself, retire, mm-hmm. and say, that's it, I abdicate, define yourselves without me. I could really do damage to their cause, I suppose.
If you were to withdraw within 2 to 3 months, there'd be a new Ernst Sandel. I think a good example of how that works, for almost 50 years, they've been hunting war criminals. Only, of course, Nazi war criminals. No one else gets tarred with that. So they hunt Eichmann, and they hunt Mengele, and of course, then they'll just pick people seemingly random, like Demyanyuk, people who've never done anything, or Wallace or the others. Finta, good example. But they're having a terrible problem because now the people from that era are dying off. There are not a bunch of Eichmanns running around, fit and trim. Anybody who might have been an officer in that era is probably a very old man and perhaps is dead already. So you're seeing a phenomenon where they're starting to look now for second generation war criminals. And what I mean by that, Mengele is a prime example now. For 20, 30 years, the hunt for Mengele, his name is kept alive. And so they find out now officially that he's dead, that they find his bones, and the world community is more or less agreed now that Mengele died, I think it was drowning. And so the new thing is, they're now saying, well, we had Mengele, the Americans had Mengele in custody, and then let him go. And now they're looking for the American officials, let him go. It's a second generation war criminal thing. They can't find the real war criminals, so now they're going after somebody who was equally evil because he had the war criminal, then let him go.
Isn't there a danger, though, that they are going to create, of course, every action creates an equal and opposite reaction, as we know about their combat against revisionism really creates new revisionists,
exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And so could it be that they are creating so many enemies because now the Christians have never done enough, right? So we have these upright Christians or whatever the version is for that park in Jerusalem, you know, where they have
the righteous Gentiles,
right?
Yeah.
How, I mean, that eventually the Gentile and Christian communities around the world possibly are ganging up because they're tired of being made feel bad. Is there a danger in that?
There's a great danger. The worst thing for the Jewish community right now is not the Ernst Sandels or the Robert Farizans or the revisionists. The worst thing for the Jewish community are the Jewish groups, the Zionist groups, the World Jewish Congress, the Anti-Defamation League, and then the Holocaust groups like the Wiesenthal Center and the Klarsfeld Foundation. The people that engage in the witch hunts, the censorship campaigns, the smear campaigns, the ones that sap public funds, whether in the form of reparations from Germany or foreign aid from the United States. These are the people who are building up resentment towards Jews because most of the time their acts are not ethical. Their acts are not voted on by the public. We've never voted in the United States on foreign aid, yet our tax money goes to it, and we have absolutely no say in the matter. So it would be one thing if at least these Jewish groups would present their case to the public and say, well, yes or no on foreign aid to Israel. And at least we would have a fair shot at seeing what the people wanted. But it's just taken because it's a big money game. Literally what it is, we're paying graft to our own politicians because we send billions of dollars over there in foreign aid. Then that money comes back to our Congress people in the form of lobbying contributions. So it's an infernal triangle where the money, we end up funding the pockets not only of the foreign aid lobby, but our own politicians as well.
And why is that dangerous for Jews as a community?
Well, there's always the possibility of a backlash. People get sick and tired, and people have a right to be angry. I think that's something that when you see groups of people in Germany protesting immigrants, whether you agree with them or not, you always have to identify that the people get angry, and sometimes you have to look at yourself and say, well, don't you get angry over things that somebody else might not be able to identify with, yet still drives you crazy? People get angry when they see their money wasted or when they see another group, a group that is not part, that is not.
Dustin Demos would call this guy a demon, just saying. He's a Nephilim, right?
Not them, or has no connection to them, telling them what to do or what to think. It's like I said last night, that the Jewish lobby is pathetically trying to institutionalize its historical point of view as everybody's historical point of view. They want to pass laws so everybody thinks the way they do. And that can create anger in people. People don't like that. People don't like having their freedoms restricted most of the time.
Do you think that it could be so dangerous as to cause a kind of a physical backlash or uprising, pogroms?
Well, hopefully not. You know, the thing is, it really depends on the character of the people involved. And I know a person like yourself, for example, never advocates physical violence. And you always try to solve your problems or to speak your piece using words, using books, or videotapes. I'm not in favor of violence, and regardless of whether they were on the revisionist side or the Holocaust side, I would not be in favor of anybody who said, go smash windows or go beat people up. That simply is not a way to solve a problem. Once again, like I said last night, if you punch somebody for writing a book, that's probably the most useless thing you can do, because 50 years from now, who will remember that punch? But the book will still be around. You have not solved anything, and that's the problem with violence. It is in the moment. It might make you feel better to hit something or smash something, but if it's not an intellectual, if the problem is an intellectual one, and if you don't offer up an intellectual solution, in the long run, you're going to lose.
No, you are that rare breed of Jewish revisionist. You're not the first one, but you are certainly the youngest one right now, and you're working yourself into a high profile one. What's your advice then to the Jewish community at large that seem to be in this grip of the Zionist lobby that hounds revisionists, both Jewish and Gentile?
I think my advice would be, and this is based on the fact that I have a lot of Jewish friends who in private tell me that they understand what I'm saying. They have either read revisionist books or simply know about it from me yakking about it all the time. They understand what I'm saying, and they're simply frightened. They're frightened to tell their parents what they feel or to say in public what they feel. The problem of the censorship of revisionism is more or less a specifically Jewish one. I mean, when I speak about Jewish groups censoring revisionists, I'm not trying to create some kind of a crazy conspiracy theory. Very, very much it is Zionist groups and Jewish groups that are behind this, and that has to be admitted openly. And since it is more or less a Jewish problem, Jews are the ones who should take a lead in trying to stop it. I think all Jews of good conscience should say censorship is wrong, fighting words with legislation and with violence and with threats and coercion is wrong. And at the very least, I'm not asking anybody to become a revisionist who doesn't want to. I'm not asking anybody to believe in something they don't want to, but everybody should hold dear the principles of free inquiry and truth and the freedom to write and to think.
But David, how do you respond then to those Jews who say, with all this stuff that is coming out during my trial, there is one woman who was interviewed at the end of the trial in one of the largest newspapers in the country, and she said they were not happy with all the stuff that came out during this trial. We didn't want so many things to come out, apparently. It's something, I'm paraphrasing her. That's what she said. What do you say to people who are afraid that the picture of the Jews being virtually the singular victim of the Second World War will be kind of geared down where they were one of many victims of that tragedy, which was the Second World War. Yeah. What do you say? How do you answer that to a Jewish person?
It's very hard to argue with somebody who is that set in their beliefs. But I think the thing that needs to be realized is you get a slanted picture of the world by only watching the news. The people who come out with signs to protest Ernst Sindel or to protest any other revisionists, and the people who are screaming and yelling and throwing stones and who will never listen to reason, these are still just a handful of people. It is still a numerical minority among Jews. Most Jews do not go out and protest and do not go out hounding revisionists because most Jews are, like most other people, still they're making a living, they're raising a family, they're part of the dynamics of life. And these are the Jews that are important. I know that I'll never be able to get through to a Shelley Shapiro or a Beata Klarsfeld. And I think there's only so much energy I can waste in trying. It's like speaking to a stone. You're really not going to get much of a response. But the Klarsfelds and the Wiesenthals and everybody, they depend on rank and file Jews, on everyday Jews. And it is these everyday Jews who I think hold the key. If they stop supporting the actions of the people who have elected themselves their leaders, many times in an unelected fashion, just saying, I'm a leader in the Jewish community. You don't need any credentials for that. You don't have to go pass a course to become a leader of the Jewish community. Literally, you just have to start an organization and bravo, there you are. And I think if rank and file Jews, or at least enough of them, Jews of good conscience and Jews that do not have any malice in their hearts towards other people if they confront these leaders and say, we don't want you representing us anymore. You don't have the right to appear on the news with a caption below your name saying Jewish community leader. There are some people whose minds we're not going to be able to change or whose actions we're not going to be able to influence, but we can at least distance ourselves from them.
How do we reach these, let's say, non-committed Jews? Mm-hmm. Have you ever kind of, as they say in court, have you addressed your mind to this question?
Many times, as a matter of fact, with only limited success. I mean, on the one hand, the fact that I am Jewish is beneficial in dealing with other Jews, because especially in the small part of the world that I've lived in Los Angeles, many people know my family or the temple that my father has gone to. And I can approach some people. They know that I'm not malicious, and they know that I don't have any malice at heart. And they'll listen to me. Many times with Bradley Smith, who I work with in Los Angeles, and myself, we have tried to get debates going, or not even debates, just discussions going with survivors of people who, Jews who perhaps were interred at Auschwitz or elsewhere. We've tried to get discussions going with them. And at first, several of these people have wanted to discuss with us, have wanted to appear on a video with us, or appear at one time a radio show about 2 years ago that we were planning, and we tried to get some people who had had firsthand experience in the camps, some Jews, to come on the show. And on a one-on-one level, they're very happy about that. But then they'll get a call from the ADL or the Wiesenthal Center saying, don't debate these people, don't talk to them, don't go near them, you'll be hurting world Jewry if you talk with Bradley Smith or David Cole. And these Jews will be pressured to withdraw from a debate. Once again, a case of the unelected leaders interfering with our attempts to establish a one-on-one dialogue with other people.
Would you say that the Jewish community then is tightly controlled, or is it the form of psychological terror or coercion, or what would you call it?
Yeah, there is a lot of coercion. I think that's the word right there.
A young Jew from the United States, whom it has been my privilege and my pleasure to meet through my work into.
So this is another part. This is a different video. This is when they actually go to Auschwitz together.
This very complex issue of Auschwitz and what happened in Auschwitz. The theme is going to be revisionism, the revising of history. I met David Cole because of my trials and ultimately my victory after a 9-year legal struggle in Canada, where I had been accused of publishing false news about the Holocaust. In other words, I doubted that the Holocaust took place in the way Hollywood always claimed it happened. And this young man, David Cole, unknown to me, watched many of my video films, read my newsletters in faraway California. He was going to go to Auschwitz to investigate firsthand as a Jew what he thought might have happened because of theoretical research and historical research. I joined David Cole on the ruins of Auschwitz, in the ruins of Auschwitz, in 1992. What a meeting. What a man. I was really impressed by this young colleague, this young comrade in arms in the struggle to free the Germans and the Jews from the monkey on their back. Revisionism is the same for Jews as it is for Germans. This young man proves it.
We have been here now for approximately 5 days. We have spent 3 days at Auschwitz, both here at Auschwitz I and at Auschwitz-Birkenau. We have been not only looking around on our own, but we have taken the official tour. We had a very friendly tour guide who tried her best to answer our questions, but found them a little too taxing for the spiel that she was given to memorize. So she brought in the supervisor of tours, who pointed things out that she could not answer. The reconstructions at Crema 1, for example, we were able to get her to specifically point to what they were. And she ended up contradicting much of what we heard as far as the official tour spiel is. Right. And then the day after that, we had an interview with Dr. Piper,
in his office. He unfortunately affirmed a lot of the propaganda, such as Jews being turned into soap by the Nazis.
He still insists on that.
He still insists on that. He hasn't learned from the Jewish groups who now claim that that never happened. It shows the power of the propaganda to stay with people even after it has been proven not to be true.
So he obviously maybe hasn't known about the Yehuda Bauer revelations that he made in the Jerusalem Post, for instance, or the Yad Vashem Museum.
Either he doesn't know or he is so attached to it that he cannot help but speak of it to another Jew, the horrible things that the Nazis did here.
Right, right, right.
But certainly he confirmed to us that, he believed it was done.
Right.
And he spoke about it as fact, not as something that is, some people say did happen and some people say didn't.
Supposedly or whatever.
Yeah.
He treated it as a historical fact.
Yeah.
No, so this is the entrance to the camp proper here. And behind us in this building, if I understand correctly, they used to have the bordello.
Yeah. Right now it's been turned into a building for archives.
They had a bordello for prisoners that they were trying to keep the morale up on, so that, you know, in the hospital and lots of other things.
For research in this, basically what happened is the people would be coming through here, through this path, and then the would be the barrier would be down. And what, German guards would be in this building over here?
Yeah, German guards would be in this building and looking down from that tower.
Right. Now, David, where do we go from the entrance here? Where will you take us?
Well, we'll go through the entrance like an inmate would. We'll show you briefly where the inmates lived and in what condition. And then we will walk up towards where the camp officials were and then finally end up at Crema 1, the supposed gas chamber.
So, David, what are we seeing?
So what you are watching right now are two separate documentaries or interviews that I put together. Both of them not in full, just parts that I found that pertained, that got the point across. Once this is over, this particular section, when they're talking here about Auschwitz, we're going to switch over to a different video, and that's going to be probably kicking off Yuri Bezmenov. If people are sick of that Yuri Bezmenov, you know, introduction with G. Edward Griffin, let me know, and I'll just skip ahead to when the In Pursuit of Truth thing begins, okay? While you're watching this, just let me know.
Well, what we're looking at now is the swimming pool. It has been restored to its original state. Dietlieb Felder has slides of it looking this way. In 1987, when David McAlden came here, it was undergoing some kind of reconstruction. We actually feared at that time it might be lost. They might either bury it or try to make it seem like a burning pit. Right. But in a somewhat unique stroke of honesty for the Poles who run this place, they have restored it perfectly as it was. Now, they do not put this on the regular tour. If you sign up and take the tour, you don't come out here. You don't ever see the swimming pool. If you ask to see it, as we did, and if you ask to know its function, you're told either, you get two answers sometimes, either that it was a swimming pool for the SS men, or the swimming pool for preferred inmates, inmates, perhaps capos inmates who helped the Nazis in some way. However, this is in the inmates part of the barracks. The SS houses are way at the other end of the camp. If the SS men were to have a swimming pool, most likely it would not be in the middle of the inmates' barracks, but would be further out where the SS men do not have to mingle with the inmates or swim while the inmates are staring at them with hatred and envy and loathing.
Wasn't there a rule that SS men only could enter the camp itself on official business?
Yeah, the inmates were allowed pretty much free rein around here. And because it's right in the middle of their barracks, it is very hard to believe that it was only for certain preferred inmates. Carlos Porter has published pictures of inmates sitting in front of the pool with the ladder in the back, the larger ladder. Yeah. And they look quite happy. They're wearing their swimming trunks, and many people don't believe that there would be a pool here. But it is also interesting to note that only three barracks down is the back of the Wall of Death, the wall where supposedly 20,000 people or more were shot up against. But this is clearly an area for the inmates' enjoyment. You have benches lining this area. They can rest here. They can recuperate. The hospital is one barrack up that way. If they were ill, if they are recuperating, they can sit here. They can swim in the pool. To have constant, not only shooting, but of course the impassioned cries of men about to be killed or as they're dying would really not mix with the way this place appears to have been built. The wall of death would have been more suited on the outskirts of this camp, because also it is no good for the inmates' morale if they are living right among the wall where they are being shot one after the other. Another important thing to note when you look at this pool, as you can see in the distance, there are three starting blocks, which look like they might have been used for swimming races, contests. This is not just a hole hastily dug. You can see there is a very nice fixture that perhaps at one time water came out of the mouth of that like a spout. There is a higher diving board. And then we have blocks, starting blocks here.
It's really in bad taste for me to say rat race, right? It's not right.
Very clearly, this was, one can imagine the inmates having races. One can imagine people being able to come here and relax after working. But it doesn't really mix with the concept of this as a death machine, this camp being a place where people come in and they die and they know they're going to die. Whenever you're taking a tour through Auschwitz, you have to be very careful to not be fooled by things that have been added since. Now, we have very good aerial photographs of Auschwitz and Auschwitz-Birkenau during the war, but we can only blow them up just so much. And there are little bits and pieces.
That was the Allies' contention of Germany during the war. We can only blow them up so much.
Pieces that might very well have been added.
In your experience, you saw this on the aerial photo.
Oh yeah, the swimming pool is definitely here. It shows that there was that this was not just some kind of trapping to fool the world to believe that Auschwitz was humane when in reality people were dying here.
So David, explain to us, what are we seeing here?
Well, this is the other side of the wall of death. So you can see that there are no bullet marks in it. There are drawings that prisoners have made of the wall of death. There are no pictures, of course. And that's a kind of an interesting thing because we know that there are pictures taken other places where the Nazis had executed people. And yet with 20,000 executions going on at the wall of death, you think that there would be just one or two pictures. It's something that the Nazis did not seem to mind recording what did happen. And of course, we've never found any pictures or recordings of gas chambers. And now this has become very much of a shrine. The groups who come here are sometimes Jewish, sometimes Catholic, and they leave their mark depending upon what kind of religious symbols they are into. We have seen in the past couple of days a lot of Israeli flags planted on this wall, which don't seem to be around right now. I suppose they have somebody who clears away the dead flowers and brings, just makes it presentable.
Now we are outside the infamous Auschwitz I gas chamber. That's where the whole story began, really. Here we are looking at the gallows where Rudolf Hess was strangled, right?
In full view of his crime.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it says here.
So the burden of proof now falls on whether this was a crime or not.
And whether it was, in fact, if the crime was committed, whether it was committed in here or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the building in the background that we are seeing here is the SS hospital or what?
Yeah, what's interesting, the three buildings on the end of the camp here are all for the SS. The furthest building was for Hess. The odd thing is the building in the closest proximity, that gray building over there, the top floor was the SS hospital, and the bottom floor was the SS canteen where they ate. As you can see, the windows of the hospital are directly across the road from the ventilation chimneys of the supposed gas chamber. Certainly poor planning on the part of the Nazis who would be jeopardizing the lives of their own men, not of inmates, but of their own men. It's impossible to think that they would construct something so badly. One would have to say that the Germans had no sense of safety or engineering or anything like this, and we know that they do, and we know that they would not have built something in proximity to the gas chamber like that.
No, This is the entrance, the one that with the mm-hmm. natural flagstones you see here. That's the entrance, the alleged entrance.
Well, now they claim now that the entrance was on the other side. They claim that this entrance, both our tour guide, the tour guide supervisor, and Dr. Piper claim that this entrance here is a complete reconstruction. It has been reconstructed for tourists, and it is where the tourists are taken in. But they now claim that the entrance for what for the victims to be gassed is on the other side of this building. The two larger chimneys were chimneys on the roof were most likely either they are reconstructions from the original or they are the original with the little metal roof there. Those there were in fact cremation ovens in this building. We know that to be true. But then there are four Zyklon B induction chimneys on the roof, which we will go and look at shortly. And they are now admitted to have been built after the fact. They are made, of course, of very flimsy wood. They are completely unconvincing, but the holes in the roof that they are over were also, we now know, drilled in the roof after the fact. It is clear that the tour tries to pass these off as original, but both the supervisor of tour guides and Dr. Piper very clearly said that the holes are not original. They are reconstructions. They were drilled in after the liberation, and the Zyklon B induction vents on top were put in after the liberation.
You can't trust the Bolshevik.
But I think it's interesting to note that the tour guides are told they're original, so that gullible tourists or people who are here to try and observe the supposed tragedy of the gas chambers can feel that they are in the room where it all happened. We also asked Dr. Piper if there had ever been any repainting or replastering done on the walls of Crema 1, because of course Crema 1 is devoid of any blue stains from Zyklon B. He said the walls were all in original shape. I asked him why then there would be no blue stains when there was not only blue staining on the inside of the lousing chambers at both Majdanek and Auschwitz-Birkenau.
And he said, get out of my office. No, just kidding.
The outside, the Zyklon B was so strong, it in fact permeated the brick and came out the other side. He said that the amount of Zyklon B used to kill people was smaller than that used to kill lice. The problem with that reasoning is at Majdanek, they claim people were gassed and there are blue stains. They're contradicting themselves. First, they say at Auschwitz, people were gassed and the amount of Zyklon B needed to gas a human being will not produce blue stains. At Majdanek, they say here people were gassed and the amount of gas will produce blue stains. They cannot have it both ways. Well, we're seeing the exact same thing we saw at the doors at Majdanek, which is that these latch from both sides, from the inside as well as the outside. Clearly, these doors were constructed to close firmly, as if in an air raid shelter, perhaps, but not to keep anybody in, because they can be manipulated on either side. At Majdanek, what they have done, they have clearly cut the inside bars on some of the doors so as not to make it apparent that they could latch from both sides, but still these can be manipulated from the inside. And then up here, we see that this has, in addition, there's a latch on the inside and nothing on the outside, and there's a hook on the inside too. We have been told by both Dr. Piper and the director of the tour guides that the holes you presently see in the ceiling were drilled here by the Poles after the war, that they were not in this room and had to be put in, had to be constructed. They say, of course, reconstructed, but the burden of proof is on them to show how they knew there were holes in here in the first place. And walls, of course.
And this is the whole point that people who want to push an agenda don't get. They don't understand. You can't just say things and then carry on with conclusions based on the things that you just say. Now, if you look into logic, if you look into Socrates and like dialogues, if you look at any of that stuff and you don't pick up on how you can shut down a conversation well before it gets kicked off into crazy land, it's because nobody's teaching you how to think anymore. And when people just take accepted values for things and then they rearrange them in a way that they like and they think is unique, you get a Dustin Nemos out of this. And I'm the only reason why I'm bringing this up again, because I'm done talking about that nonsense, is a simple fact that there was no logic being followed. It's this is true because it says so, not because there's an, and I will just speak out and say that there's evidence, but yeah, I'm not going to show any. And then I'm going to talk over you the rest of the time. And then everybody's going to say that Dan, this guy here, is somehow talking over him. Well, it's my show and he's being rude. So, and also the reason why I shut down talks like that is because you're going somewhere that you don't have a basis to go any further with. So I'm shutting that part down. I'm saying, well, that's not a valid source. Period. The end. And well, it is a valid. Well, no, it isn't. Show me something else. And then you just, you know, circular logic till we get back to the same argument again and the same problem. It was going nowhere. And that's why that won't ever happen again. Not
these
on this
walls,
show.
They admit to having knocked down when I believe at some point this room was used as an air raid shelter. And you can see that walls come out from opposite sides and there are doorways. This very clearly was the doorway where there was a wall here. And here's another one of the fake induction chimneys. Interesting to note while we're in this room that in his book, By Bread Alone, Mel Mermelstein talks about, he shows a picture of this gas chamber and he says, note the fake shower heads. And of course, you can see from the picture and you can see from being here that there are no fake shower heads and they have never claimed there to be fake shower heads. Someday, perhaps we will have an idea about all of the changes, who made them.
Russian Bolshevik Jews. I shouldn't even use the word Russian in that, actually.
Why they were made. But at least now we have the beginning, we have the admissions. Over here we have the brick barracks. Right. As many of them have new roofs, but as far as the actual barracks, they are in their original state. There were stoves in each of the barracks. You can see there are chimneys in each of the barrack buildings. The stoves have been removed, but the chimneys remain, and they haven't.
I think it's cool how you can tell he's in an empty building because you can hear the echo off the walls. It's not his microphone being bad. It's just where he's at, the acoustics inside of it.
Been tampered with too much. And the reconstructed chimneys, all those chimneys that we see both there and to our right have all been reconstructed to show people where barracks had been at one time. Then when we look straight ahead, now this is of course where...
So they rebuilt chimneys to make it look more, what, creepy and auspicious?
Where the trains would go, they would enter the building we're standing on right now. They come through the gate and... We all, I think both sides, revisionist and exterminationist, admit that there were in fact selections, that the men and women were sent to different sides. There was a women's camp, men's camp. Where the exterminationists take it one step further is they claim that at some times all the Jews, sometimes only the Jews that couldn't work, were selected to go to their deaths. We were told by our tour guide that oftentimes...
Only radical, murderous communists were sent directly to their death. And rightly so. I applaud that. We should do that here.
The people selected to die as they were being marched to Crema 2 and 3 would begin to riot because they would see the burning smokestacks.
And you see how this, like, you can let your imagination carry yourself away. And the less people stop you and put you in check, the further the fantasy goes. And this is why I don't let that happen. I'm not here to listen to rumors, hearsay, or any of that stuff. I want people to, if you're going to base it in reality, what you can prove, not, I mean, and again, this whole taking it into the crazy land with like, oh, it's demons and that and the other thing, that all might be a real thing. But how about we talk about the stuff that we can prove so that we can actually be convincing and not sound crazy? Why don't we start with the stuff that's logical, the things that we can actually, you know, not lose people along the way and discuss that rather than taking it into crazy town right away. You can build up to that and make a case for, hey, these things are potentially this or potentially that or whatever, or this, there's an evil presence that's, you know, occupying certain people or whatever. But you don't start there. And you don't just throw people in the water like that. You say, hey, this is a buildup of, hey, these are all the natural things that we can actually, you know, have a conversation with everybody about because it's tangible. And then you can work on your theory after the fact. But the whole fact that you can't start with a basis, right? You have to, and this is what, this is this type of fantasy where like, oh, they're giving this whole scenario of how this thing went down when none of this actually happened. How did they get to do that? No one put them in check because no one had the facts back then. So they just accepted the narrative. And this is so detrimental to everything that's going on right now in our human history since then, that it's important that you don't let people just carry on with their nonsense. You have to put them in check. Okay. And it's like ridicule is a good thing because it keeps people in check. It keeps them from going too far off the rails with their fantasies and their self-serving fantasies at that.
And yet there is not now, nor was there ever any fencing at the farthest end of the camp. And there are two ditches, two rather long running ditches that run over there as well, making it fairly easy for 3,000-4,000 people to escape. I mean, certainly you have two guard towers and they could be firing into the crowd and maybe hit 100 or 200 people, but the majority of them would have escaped. It was bad planning to do it that way. The end of the camp looks far more suited for a morgue.
That's a big point though. Having the whole like concept of that, putting it into practice in reality would not have been a logical way of handling a group of people if they were in fact trying to get away and not happy to be there, or at least not horrified to be there, right? They had to be in compliance to want to be there.
Where only dead people and the people carrying the dead people would go, then a gas chamber where thousands of living people would march to their death.
And I say want to be there in contrast to being in a potential war zone, because by that time, the 40s, there was bombings randomly everywhere. He was pulling them out of the cities. He was putting them in these areas. Now, Auschwitz is Poland, so there's a little bit, I believe it is, right? Am I screwing that up? I don't remember. It doesn't matter.
Deaths.
Now, that beige patch is the selection ramp, you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is that, asphalt or is it concrete? Or is it
I'm not sure what that is or what it was during the 40s. And of course, at the very...
Yeah, so it's, I was right. I just, you know, double check myself too. So Poland was a different story because Germans were being slaughtered there to kick off the war. So there was a lot of communism, you know, a lot of communists in that area. So those people most certainly got flushed out before there was even a reason to put and contain people. But that, again, doesn't necessarily mean they all came from Poland. But again, that's the thing. They weren't in battle zones and they had all these amenities. So what does that tell you? Soccer fields, swimming pools, morale for people who are going to work, because that's the thing here. We feed you, we keep you here away from potential attacks by other Germans being pissed off with you, and you're going to work for us. A mark's worth of work for a mark, right? Like you said in the past.
Farthest end is the monument to the victims. The plaques are now not inscribed with anything because they have lowered their death toll. Dr. Piper gave us a rather long explanation as to why they originally claimed 4 million deaths and now only claim a little over a million. But everybody seems to be saying the same thing in unison now, that the 4 million was a mistake and that it never should have been said. But of course, it was said here for quite some time.
Like four decades.
Yeah, indeed. And
a 40-year mistake by 3 million people. And that's still not a correct number, but they have to have some number. But they already got the effect, right? They already scared Jews into Palestine at that period in time. They scared them into promoting and supporting Zionism. So here we are.
Figures, like many of the figures for the Holocaust, were taken quite unquestionably from the communists. They were given, and we never really questioned much about their accuracy.
There were some inmates.
Yes, let them tell you their history, because there's definitely no reason for them to lie. Oh, wait, they did kind of do that with the OT.
Like Paul Resine and some people who were here, like Thijs Christoffersen, who had the integrity
to speak. They never saw any of these things that were claimed, but there was a lot of early propaganda that was dropped because it was too ridiculous sounding. Steam chambers, electro chambers, much of this is listed in Carlos Porter's book on Nuremberg. The gas chambers.
For those of you listening on the radio, it said Made in Russia, the Holocaust. It was a book.
Stuck around, I think, as the last piece of atrocity propaganda to fall. But I think we will see the end of that by the end of this century. But
I hope so.
As the day ends, let's say here's to a new beginning in German-Jewish relationships.
I hope
and
so.
For
I hope so.
Historical integrity.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, that you and I can turn over a new leaf and get this thing behind us.
Okay, so that was 1992 era, 91-92, right about. Now we're going to switch over to the other video. Just give me a second because it's cumbersome. Hi, good morning, everybody. Yeah, so I kind of told in a live chat because I didn't want to bother because it was already late, but internet. The one for CenturyLink wasn't working on my computer, so I have other things set up here laptop wise because the cable one works for the laptop, but it won't in here because my desktop had a BIOS hack over a year ago, just before my very first interview with Mike Adams and my returning guest, Dr. Artis, at the time. So, yeah, that was kind of nerve wracking. Luckily, I had a Josh, and Josh was able to get me back on solid ground again. You know, I think there's a Schultz-Nitzen part coming up next. Let me see if that's case. Maybe we'll. Nope, I don't know where that one went. There's a Schultz-Nitzen part in one of these. Anyway, that I had added in the beginning of the video, but I don't see it right now. So, did anybody give me a verdict on this? We're gonna be playing the next video, but. Are we doing the, because we have like 30 minutes, are we going to listen to Yuri Bezmenov again? It's and then have very little time for the actual In Pursuit of the Truth thing, or should I just move it up? You tell me. Oh, wait, the Schultz-Nitzen thing is on this one. All right. Well, I can fix that then. Let's just bring it to right about there. All right. I got this, bro. We're going to skip over the Yuri Bezmenov thing. I think everybody's seen it probably 300 times. So, not that it's important. It puts it right into perspective, but let's just do this. Ba-da-da. So, if you're not familiar with Sir Patrick Mack, In Pursuit of Truth used to be a channel on YouTube. And granted, you know, here's what I will say in positive, you know, to the efforts of Sir Patrick Mack. Number one, he was funny. He was very entertaining. He wasn't like a X-22 Dave type of person, although he did cover a lot of QAnon stuff. But what he did do with it is he would take the little bit of information that was all stupid and cryptic and, like, you know, talking in riddles and all that bullshit, and he would actually find a lot, you know, like a logical stream of things, like, you know, potential tunnels from the Getty Museum into these places where they're running guns and children and all sort of stuff. So he, you know, and he would look at the, you know, they were talking about dogs, like lost dog, bad dog, and all the, they would continue to use these references and then probably talking about child trafficking and, you know, lost dog. It's kind of like in that movie. No, it's not in the movie. It's in the book, Hearts in Atlantis. When they're looking for the guy who got away, which is, you know, the Silence of the Lambs guy in the movie, Anthony Hopkins, but he's special. He has abilities, right? So they're trying to get him back, trying to find him, and they put up all these lost dog posters in the city because that's how they communicate with one another, and they know their own cryptic, you know, symbolism. And it there's a lot to be said there, and there's a lot to unpack there, and it's referencing quite a deep thought. So. He kind of went into that a lot, and I found that to be interesting, even if it was based off of, you know, there was truth to Q. It was just where they were steering you that wasn't good, right? So that I'll say about it. And this particular 6 or 5 part documentary is very good. So I took this chunk out of it. I have 4 different videos where I represented it. And he actually talked about the Frankists in one of them. So that's pretty cool.
Many of you have already found, and others will find out.
So those of you listening, this is Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
In the course of their lives.
Someone reading his words, of course.
That the truth eludes us if we do not concentrate our attention totally on its pursuit. But even while it eludes us...
I added this too. This is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the author of Gulag Archipelago. That's not my fault. That's from the original video. My bad. I didn't repeat myself just now.
The illusion of knowing it still lingers and leads to many misunderstandings. Also, truth seldom is pleasant. It is almost invariably bitter. There is some bitterness in my today's speech too, but I want to stress that it comes not from an adversary, but from a friend. The Western world has lost its civil courage, both as a whole and separately, in each country, each government, each political party, and of course in the United Nations. Such a decline in courage is particularly noticeable among the ruling groups and the intellectual elite, causing an impression of loss of courage by the entire society. Of course, there are many courageous individuals, but they have no determining influence on public life. Should one point out that from ancient times, declining courage has been considered the beginning of the end? When the modern Western states were created, the principle was proclaimed that governments are meant to serve man, and man lives to be free and to pursue happiness. See, for example, the American Declaration of Independence. Now at last, during past decades, technical and social progress has permitted the realization of such aspirations, the welfare state.
Now, before we go any further, no, I'm going to skip over what the hell, whatever I was saying there. I don't care. The alumbrato. Yeah, I don't care. Let's get back to it. Our Jesus Christ. Kabbalistic faction.
Which the Russian government is writing today. 6 million Jews, one half of the Jewish people throughout the world, are being persecuted, hounded, humiliated, tortured, starved. Thousands of them have been slaughtered. Hundreds of thousands of Jews, old men, women, and children, are being driven mercilessly from town to town. There it is, people. 6 million Jews. One half of the Jewish people throughout the world are being persecuted, hounded, humiliated, tortured, and starved. As I go along here, support here as well. Dear brethren, have mercy on the 6 million Jews in Russia and take our part.
In Russia?
Again. 6 million Jews in Russia. 1915. This is 18 years before Hitler ever set foot in the government. 18 years.
He was holding in his hand the book of Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemo, Mankind, translated to Hebrew. And he started to read from the book Why Hitler Hated Jews. You're not gonna believe it.
This is the next newspaper. This is New York Times again. It's from 1918. There it is, the New York Times. October the 18th, 1918.
You'd only watch any Hollywood movie, turn on the TV to any World War II documentary, or visit any public library.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to hear a very frightening speech. This speech is an explanation of the plans now being laid to throw the United States into a third world war.
There it is. 6 million souls will need help to resume normal life when war is ended. 6 million souls.
That's Talmudic and Kabbalistic, right? They need... They take, there's one letter that represents six, and it's not translated over into the next phase, that say that they're going to be taken out of wherever and brought back to their homeland. So they interpret that to mean that less 6 million. So they have to have the 6 million be gone, be done away with, in order for the religious who follow that to see that as a cue, as a marker that this is meant to be, and this is the next progression, is to go into Palestine and Jerusalem and take back, quote unquote, right, the land.
Lost by conquest, all our organically grown.
You can hear Ernst Zundel in the background there.
Institutions.
Mass meeting hears that 127,000 Jews have been killed and 6 million are in peril.
This is not a Jewish meeting. This is the conscience of America making itself felt.
It was international Zionism that wanted to destroy Germany and Hitler.
And what I tell you now concerns not only you, but your children and the survival of this country and Christianity. Well, I don't want to go by what they were called. We're now using English words, and what they were called in Germany is not very material, but they were communists because in 1917, the communists took over Germany for a few days. Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and a group of Jews in Germany took over the government for 3 days. In fact, when the Kaiser ended the war, he fled to Holland because he thought the communists were going to take over Germany as they did Russia, and that he was going to meet the same fate that the Tsar did in Russia. So he left and went to Holland for safety, for security. At that time, when the communist threat in Germany was quashed, it was quiet, the Jews were working still, trying to get back into their former status, and the Germans fought them in every way they could without hurting a hair on anyone's head. The same as one group, the prohibitionists, fought the people who were interested in liquor, and they didn't fight one another with pistols. They did it every way they could. Well, that's the way they were fighting the Jews in Germany. And at that time, mind you, there were 80 to 90 million Germans, and there were only 460,000 Jews. Less than one half of 1% of the population of Germany were Jews. And yet, they controlled all the press. They controlled most of the economy because they had come in and with cheap money, you know, the way the mark was devalued, they bought up practically everything. Well, in 1933, when Germany refused to surrender, mind you, to the World Conference of Jews in Amsterdam, they broke up, and Mr. Untermyer came back to the United States, who was the head of the American delegation and the president of the whole conference, and he went from the steamer to ABC and made a radio broadcast throughout the United States in which he said, "The Jews of the world now declare a holy war against Germany. We are now engaged in a sacred conflict against the Germans, and we are going to starve them into surrender. We are going to use a worldwide boycott against them that will destroy them because they are dependent upon their export business." And it is a fact that two-thirds of Germany's food supply had to be imported, and it could only be imported with the proceeds of what they exported, their labor. So if Germany could not export, two-thirds of Germany's population would have to starve. There just was not enough food for more than one-third of a population. Now, in this declaration, which I have here, it was printed and paid a whole page in the New York Times on August 7th, 1933, Mr. Samuel Untermeyer boldly stated that this economic boycott is our means of self-defense. President Roosevelt has advocated its use in the NRA, which some of you may remember, where everybody was to be boycotted unless they followed the rules laid down by the New Deal, which of course was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court at that time. Nevertheless, the Jews of the world declared a boycott against Germany, and it was so effective that you couldn't find one thing in any store anywhere in the world with the words "Made in Germany" on it.
And there's been parallels there between Obamacare and the New Deal, just in the sense that it doesn't matter what the Supreme Court rules, they just keep pushing ahead anyway.
January 30th, 1933. Adolf Hitler is appointed Chancellor of Germany. The former Austrian soldier and statesman is now a major figure in a coalition government. Hitler was appointed by Paul von Hindenburg, the second-elect president of the German Weimar Republic. After having dissolved the Reichstag twice in 1932, Hindenburg was ultimately the one to secure the National Socialist Party's power, even though he was personally opposed to Hitler. Hindenburg was not only a Lutheran Protestant, but a direct descendant of Martin Luther and his wife, Katharina von Bora, through their daughter, Margaret Luther. Like Hitler, Hindenburg was a military man and statesman, having served in the Austro-Prussian Seven Weeks War of 1866 and the Franco-German War of 1870, and retiring in 1911. He was called back to service in 1914 as the superior of expert strategist Major General Erich Ludendorff. Their success earned Hindenburg even more public acclaim, and he was promoted to the rank of Field Marshal and eventually command all land forces. Hindenburg had known the struggle of later dealing with left-wing radical uprisings throughout Germany, but still had his share of criticism for the Republican view. He retired again in 1919, viewed largely as a nonpartisan. But in 1925 came the death of Friedrich Ebert. Paul von Hindenburg became the second president of the Weimar Republic. He ran again in 1932, seen as the only candidate who could defeat Adolf Hitler. Centrist Catholics and Social Democrats kept Hindenburg in office, but Hitler's movement was not to be denied and would prove useful, even if unpleasant, as allies. Two governments were emerging, the first led by Franz von Papen, a wealthy Westphalian Catholic scion and diplomat who helped dissolve the Weimar government. Papen was a soldier in World War I and military attaché in Washington, D.C., to the German ambassador. As a diplomat to the U.S. and Mexico, Papen assisted the Mexican government in procuring arms for the Victoriano Huerta administration, which collapsed soon after. He had done the same in Germany, purchasing weapons during the First World War. On the 22nd of August, 1914, a series of bombings against Allied supporting New York City businesses were carried out, led by Detective Paul Koenig, who was hired by Papin. With massive donations coming from Berlin, Franz opened a front company and preclusively purchased hydraulic presses to prevent artillery shell production, and also produced fake passports for Germans to leave for home. The second party, led by Kurt von Schleicher, last chancellor of the Weimar Republic, who pushed for a more authoritative regime. Schleicher was a former army officer, an opponent of Hitler and Heinrich Brüning, the foreign minister and man responsible for dissolving the Reichstag. Neither party would be able to win the support of the National Socialists. Hitler demanded to be chancellor of any government in which he and his party were involved, but Hindenburg would not concede. However, in November of 1932, Papen and Hitler agreed on a government, with Hitler as chancellor, Papen as vice chancellor. With Schleicher's efforts for parliamentary support losing steam, Hindenburg called for his resignation. On January 30, 1933, Hindenburg appointed Adolf Hitler as chancellor. his cabinet only consisting of two National Socialists, Wilhelm Frick and Hermann Göring. The modern-day belief is that Adolf Hitler began immediately suppressing rights of Jews in Germany, but no sanctioned campaigns occurred. The violence...
Blue eyes there. Interesting.
...that did occur was already ongoing and were principally because of the Jewish involvement in World War I. At this time, Hitler was not the undisputed ruler of Germany. He was not yet in control of the military and would not be until a consolidation of power that occurred later. February 14, 1933, the Central Association of German Citizens of Jewish Faith released a statement voicing their concern for Hitler and offering support for Hindenburg. Nevertheless, we are convinced that no one will dare to violate our constitutional rights. Zentralverein Deutscher Staatsbürger Jüdischen Glaubens, or Central Association of German Citizens of Jewish Faith, began in 1893, founded to promote Jewish social equality and protect from anti-Semitism. Much of their energy was spent attempting to dispel the ages-old idea that they were part of an international Jewish syndicate. 2 weeks after the statement, the Krefeld chapter held an event titled The Future of the German Jews, featuring Julius Brodnitz and Arthur Sandilowski. Multiple incidents were reported in the surrounding days of the event, such as windows being smashed and even gunfire. The February 23rd issue of Zentralverein Zeitung reported of the event. Brodnitz and Sandilowski stressed, "There is not the slightest reason to depart from our association's basic principles. Our deep inner bond with both German culture and Judaism should help us overcome all the difficulties besetting us." Brodnitz died a few years later in 1936 as a result of a concussion suffered in an automobile accident. He had three sons, one being Otto Brodnitz, who was employed by investment banker Louis Frank Rothschild, a graduate of Columbia University and partner of Leonard A. Hochstadt.
Columbia University, may as well just say Frankfurt School.
From Kuhn and Loeb, the firm that funded much of the First World War.
Yeah, Jacob Schiff was Kuhn and Loeb too.
Rothschild was married to Cora Guggenheim of the famed Guggenheim family. But even the Zentralverein did not believe that the new government was inciting anti-Jewish uprisings, stating, "We do not believe our German fellow citizens will let themselves be carried away into committing excesses against the Jews." But this was not enough for the Jewish community. They wanted war.
The decay of our culture, these mounds of... contamination of our whole cultural life. Yeah, it's probably talking about Berlin, mostly. The decomposition of our literature. This sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds like what's going on now. The poisoning of our theaters. Of our movie theaters, all the art is now falling for it. Yes, make the art ugly. Millions of Germans do not participate anymore. It does not appeal to them anymore. This art that was not born from our people, but is alien to us and will remain alien. Remember, Habru Sagaz, the foreigners from on the other side of the river, right? Aliens. That has nothing to do with the German character and did not come from our soul. It was imposed on our people by a subversive press. Which made it palatable. And parallel to this, Already the assault begins against the education of our children, our children's brains. The tearing out of all memories of our German past. If this does not sound like what's happening with us right now, the education and the literature and the movies, the media, I mean, this is a parallel to what was going on in Germany. They're doing it here. If you don't think that they have control, look around you. The insult to all the great men of our people. The removal of its memory from the heart and brain. Out of the German youth. And with a large defilement of the German history. Nothing of what was once great, nothing of what helped create this state and this nation. To make it strong. Was spared from these corroding and corrosive attacks. I always say eroding, so hey, we talk alike. Everything is demolished, starting from the symbol. Of the past, from the cockades of flags to the great men of our history. Yes, destroying history, another thing, right? It's 9:57 right now. We'll play this till it hits the 10 a.m. mark on my clock, and then we will pick this up tomorrow because this is important. It's not necessarily have to play the whole thing, but...
March 4, 1933. The United States inaugurates Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Now you can make a contrast between this piece of crap and what Germany had, which we wish we should be so lucky to have a Hitler over there, over here during that time period.
As the 32nd president, his speech was heard by tens of millions.
This guy right here was responsible for the starvation death of over 3 million Americans because of his stupid bullshit with the making the depression, which was a banker's depression, making that intensifying it exponentially worse with his programs.
Millions of anxious Americans, desperate for hope at the height of the Great Depression. March 12th, the American Jewish Congress announced a protest at New York City's Madison Square Garden, scheduled for the 27th. A call for an American boycott of all German goods raged throughout New York and other major cities. March 23rd, 20,000 rally at New York City Hall and shipping stations for North German Lloyd and Hamburg America.
Dr. Stephen S. Wise, rabbi of the Free Synagogue and the national leader of liberal thought, speaks in behalf of the Jews of the United States.
This is not a Jewish meeting. This is the conscience of America making itself felt.
Really? You speak on behalf of all of us?
The next day, on the 24th, London's Daily Express releases the famed headline, Judea declares war on Germany. Jews of all the world unite. Boycott of German goods. The whole of Israel throughout the world is uniting to declare an economic and financial war on Germany. The appearance of the swastika as the symbol of the new Germany has revived the old war symbol of Judas to new life. 14 million Jews scattered over the entire world are tied to each other as if one man, in order to declare war against the German persecutors of their fellow believers. The Jewish wholesaler will quit his house, the banker his stock exchange, the merchant his business, and the beggar his humble hut, in order to join the holy war against Hitler's people. From the Jewish publication, Not a Wretch.
All right, I think we're going to call it right there. It's 10 a.m., and I do have backup set up in place now in case the internet thing happens again, but you know, desert and wind, things happen, especially when it's CenturyLink. Go check out the go check out the book. Look at the description. There's new stuff in there. In fact, let me show you. It's here. Whoops, not there. This one. All right, so on my website, SemperFryLLC.com, there's a fan favorite coupon right here, and that's 5% off in addition to the sale prices. And over here in the top right, you can subscribe to Dr. Peter Glidden, like you know you should. All right, and you can get two extra live Q&As with him every week, Tuesdays and Thursdays usually. And then this is for Dr. Monzo, Ballbusters 15, all one word, capital B's and 15, 15% off at his store, and you get his book. You can get it electronically or you can get it in the hard copy. Aleph Taf Body System, understand the energetic pathways of your toroidal field, of your aura, of your soul, and put it back in line. You can look at his book for that and other things he has there, including tuning forks, magnets, the energy iodine, all kinds of things. I don't know if he can do the DNA test yet because of what's going on with the FDA and all that craziness rating him for no good reason. And then over here, the Azure Well. So this also helps Dr. Monzo, okay? Both of these sites do. This is Dr. Monzo over here on the far right bottom. And BB5 for 5% off for life, the Azure Well. You click this, just click the picture, and it brings you right to. And I've gone over this before, but I'm showing you again. There's the Icelandic cod liver, which I have. And all these were helped. Dr. Monzo helped design and make sure that these were all whole food. No crap holder in them, no extra junk. And there's a whole food vitamin C complex right there. There's a multivitamin right there. There's the fulvic humic acid, which I have. Core copper, which I have. There's a bentonite detoxification clay right there. Look at that. Oh, boy. And then you just hit load more and scroll down the list. You'll find all kinds of good stuff here. Turmeric and ginger powder, glutathione. You get it. The list goes on. Good stuff. And there's also the IP6, which helps get rid of the excess of iron in your system. And then there's testosterone support for men. Put that together with my boom, 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 creatine HCL, and you'll be rocking and rolling. All right. There's a 50 serving size and there's a 100 serving size. Same container because it fits both. But the standard out there is the 46 or 48 servings per container. So I said, excuse that, we're going to do 50. I'm going to do it cheaper than they do. And then the double is $42.99. And then you have the 5% off coupon. And you just scroll down after you read some of this. There's actually a link here so you can read more about it. Okay. And I've went over that last night. But this is kind of interesting. So since I'm here, let me talk about it real quick. So it says, this health line, can you guys see it all right? Yes, you can. Is creatine safe and more side effects? Do-do-do. The majority of research suggests creatine supplementation is safe when taken at the recommended daily dose. That said, some people avoid creatine because they worry about certain myths. And then they say they think all these things happen. Kidney damage, liver damage, yada, 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 bloating, dehydration, muscle cramps, all that stuff, right? And then the breakdown is creatine a steroid? No. Naturally found in the body, 95% of it is in your muscles, which is said right here. And it's produced from two amino acids, glycine and L-arginine, which is a vasodilator too, by the way. And that's something that you add to a pre-workout, which will be coming up soon. That's my next thing. But let me give you my rundown. I made a copy of all this information for the most part and put it into, what did I put it? Right here. So creatine, this is the thing I was working on with TikTok to try to put this up on the shop. Creatine HCL, clean source supplements by SemperFryLLC.com, is a keto-compliant single-ingredient health supplement for muscle strength, focus, and muscle energy. Studies have shown creatine to be beneficial to men and women and is even used clinically for certain child muscle diseases. This all comes off that Healthline. It has been linked to bone health, improved mood, and mental cognition. That's actually more specific to women as well, and premenopause issues too. Helps to alleviate them. It may help manage impacts of sleep deprivation, and when used topically, may reduce wrinkles. Topically, rub it on your face, right? HCL is the most potent form, and no loading phase is necessary, unlike creatine monohydrate. Creatine may have several benefits, such as increasing athletic performance, muscle mass, endurance, and preventing chronic diseases. Creatine supplementation may provide more. Why is this a different font? Why do they do that? I don't understand these things. Creatine. This is why I had such a hard time writing my book on this freaking LibreOffice stuff. It would change the color of my font, and it would change it itself. The color of my text. It was irritating. Creatine supplementation may provide more health benefits beyond athletic performance, such as reduced liver fat, heart disease risk, obviously lowered, and antioxidant benefits, control blood sugar levels, slow down cancer progression, and improve osteoarthritis symptoms and cognitive function. Over time with exercise, creatine HCL shows an increase in muscle mass and a decrease in body fat more than exercise alone. Creatine has been used for more than a century, with hundreds of studies to support its safety and effectiveness. Well, technically, if it's part of your body, it's been used for however many years you want to believe the humans have been around. Creatine is naturally found throughout the body, with 95% found in the muscle tissue. Adding more through supplementation optimizes many functions, including what your body needs to build increased muscle mass. Your diet intake and natural creatine levels are about 50% of what's needed for maximum muscle growth. Recommended use, 750 milligrams per 100 pounds of body weight. However, studies show usages of 3 to 5 grams daily and even more have no adverse side effects. Read the product label for more. The International Society of Sports Nutrition, ISSN, regards creatine as safe and concludes it's one of the most beneficial sports supplements available. Why do you think I started with this one? It's simple. It's a single ingredient. And ta-da. It's clean source, and it's not going to mess up your keto. There's no additives. There's no weird sugar or sucralose or anything like that in it. And there's no maltodextrin. This is a clean source supplement. It won't throw you off of your efforts to get fit and get healthy, because sugar itself is a poison. I'm telling you, it crashes your immune system, all that stuff. You don't need it. You don't need it. Your body can create glucose out of lots of different things. It doesn't need to have straight sugar or carbs. It's not required. All right. And oh, by the way, I just realized I fasted all day yesterday. Look at that. It's 10:08. So technically, if you don't count the milk that I had at 7 a.m., I've been rocking and rolling for over 30 hours. But if you count that, then it's been 24, 25, 26, 27 hours. But yeah, there you go. I didn't even think about it until just now. I guess that's good. Maybe that means I need to do it another day. That's my reward, right? More punishment. My reward is more punishment. See, I'm not even nice to myself. And then you see that there's the labels on here. I don't know what KTTO means, but there's stupid freaking. It looks better on this one. It's right there. That's the one I got. Keep a keto on the label. See that? But I had to make that on a different thing. And then ta da da! Looks so pretty. So that's in the description now. When you go over here. You go, hey, look at the description. Oh, by the way, the video that I just was playing, I put in the live chat. All right. It's in live chat and Rumble. And so right there, creatine, HCL, and there's the link directly to it. And then there's the code telling you once again about it. And then all the basic stuff I put up, instead of putting it at the bottom, I put the links to the Twitter, the Instagram, the Telegram, and all that stuff. And the GoFundMe, by the way, trying to get to New York with my daughter. Any support on the GoFundMe would be greatly appreciated. To GoFundMe, or you can do the Gifts and Go. I have both open. I haven't even been back home yet since my grandfather passed. I haven't been back home in like a decade, honestly. I think I met my parents in Florida at our at their timeshares that I used to go to when I was a kid. When my daughter was two, she's about to turn eight. So that's the last time I've seen my family, right? I think they may have come to visit once, either before or after that, for like a couple of days. But that was it. And I got to see my brother when he passed through San Diego back when I still lived there because of his job. But other than that, my brother's 10 years younger than me. 10 years and 7 days. All right. There you go. There's all the links. Please, you know, visit them. Whoops. I was in the process of, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Oh, man, I just cleared it. Oops. Whoopsie. I was trying to upload the next one. Day eight. All right. Well, anyway. And then this is the givesendgo.com/ballbusters. Please help out the show. Right now, the reason why I couldn't get started today on regular time is because over a year ago, a BIOS hack, something happened where I looked at my computer and the whole image, the whole icon for the internet was missing. And when you go into the settings and you click it, it flashes and crashes. Something's suppressing me from having internet. That seems very specific to something that doesn't want you to continue to do whatever it is that you're doing, right? And for the morons out there who said, I must be getting paid to whatever, debunk anybody or Dustin in general are retarded. He gets paid. He gets paid. You're getting it right backwards, buddy. He gets paid. I don't. I don't get paid anything. He's the one on HBO doing stuff, stupid stuff about, you know, QAnon back in the day, picking whatever fad the agenda is pushing at the time. So anyhow, yeah, I don't get that. That does not happen. Hey, anonymous giver. Oh, wait, I think it just needs to be refreshed. Yeah, that was a day. Thank you so much, anonymous giver and anonymous giver squared or cubed or whatever. Squared. Yeah, so appreciate it, everybody. It's going to help us get there. I haven't seen my family forever, my daughter and I. This is going to be an awesome trip if we get to go. And that would be wonderful. Any help would be appreciated. You can use this one or you can go to the GoFundMe that's in the link in the video as well. Both will work there. Both will get there to me. Where the hell did it go? Oh, right here. This is the GoFundMe link. The Gifts and Go is floating around here somewhere too. As always, it should be. I don't see it, but I'm sure it's in there. It's just givesendgo.com/ballbusters, but why I can't see it right now. Oh, there it is right there. Christos Family Apocalypse Fund. I try to be funny, but it's kind of true. Keep it keto should be the t-shirt design with Semper Fry LLC on the sleeve as well. Yeah, I like that. I like that, Thrasher. Keep it keto. Yeah. As soon as I can do a body reveal, I'm not quite there yet, but I'll show you what I've been working on to try to be fit for 40, about to be 45. Oh my God. It's crazy. It's sad too, because it's like, that means all I already saw my grandfather pass, my grandmother Wong way too soon, but this is the part of life where things get taken away from you. You don't get the fruits of it anymore. You turn the corner, you know? So the first thing you can do is to keep yourself healthy if you have children that depend on you. And that's kind of important. And plus, if something is about to go down, it would be helpful if you weren't useless during a time of crisis when you had to run and gun or whatever you got to do, find, forage, whatever it is. So there's that. We ran over a little bit today, but I was a little bit late. So if anybody has anything they want to say in the comments, in the live chat for me to share on the screen before I get out of here, go for it. My daughter threw up twice yesterday, so I'm not sure if our plans are going to be the same. Cardio is king. Fatties will perish. Well, I mean, that's kind of true. You don't have to run fastest, just have to run faster than you, right? Isn't that what they say? And, they also try to trip you. But there it is. Yeah, it's going to be messed up on the screen because, of course, it is a green screen behind me, so it's green screen sensitive. But there it is. All right. QTHCO. Bitty bam. And I do take it every day. I take 2.5 scoops, which is about this. The scoop that I'm getting is going to be about a gram size, 960 milliliters, almost or milligrams. So close enough. That's the only spoon they have, right? So got that. This one's a 750 milligram scoop. So I take 1, 2, almost 3 of those before I go on the elliptical. But on the next one, the new one, I probably only take 2 for 2 grams. 2 grams on the elliptical, and if I go to the gym, 2 more. That's for me. I'm not telling anybody else to do that. It says 750 milligrams per 100 pounds. Being that I don't know a whole lot of 100-pound people out there, I got the scoop that was about a gram, so that kind of right about where most people will be at if they're at my weight, at least. Alrighty. See you guys tomorrow. We'll finish this section of this video up tomorrow, so it'll be kind of like a longer stitch into the documentary that we've been watching that is banned from Rumble. Hopefully this won't be. All right, bye. Oh, thanks, Thrasher. How about the show? Get the book. Do all the other things. Check out the website out. It's awesome.